This is MR Radio. I'm GW. Daniel is with us as ever. Our guest today is Colin Liddell. He's a Scottish journalist living in Japan. He's one of the two editors of Alternative Right. And as well as writing there, he also produces articles for Countercurrents and Occidental Observer. And today we're going to be talking about a smorgasbord of mostly current affairs, I think it's a fair way to put it. Colin, thanks very much for
It's great to be on the show, yeah. GW, so thanks to you and Daniel for inviting me.
So thanks for coming.
Okay, story of the moment is Mr. Roof, whose murderous ways are being bent and twisted by a lot of anti-racist, anti-white language. Do you think that there's anything that is different in the way that Roof has behaved from, say, Breivik, you know, an obvious signs of psychopathy like his? Or do you think this guy was acting politically?
Well, it's on the surface, it seems to have some kind of similarities to the case of Breivik, but done with less efficiency and on a smaller scale. But there are already quite a few problems with the narrative. So people have started to raise all sorts of questions about what's really going on. And one of the most remarkable things that I've seen recently about this case was this interview the BBC did with Roof's friends, and one of them is black.
Yes.
And he was basically saying this guy was completely not a racist. He never treated me any differently from white people, and he never said anything racist at all. And they seem to be quite good friends. And people who have been looking at his Facebook page, which I think it's now been taken down, but on that Facebook page, he did seem to have quite a lot of black friends. So he's either a very extremely split personality, or possibly some form of brainwashing and hypnosis. So, you know, the mind boggles, really.
There are ordinary explanations that, for example, the fact that as we're in a mixed situation, you simply can't be explicit about some views, and you might have to wear a different hat for different situation. You're not going to go up to a black person and talk about your racial theories with them.
Yeah, I mean, he was very kind of friendly with this black guy until, just a few days ago. And so it would be a quite a radical change of direction. The narrative that's being pushed just seems to lack that sort of note of plausibility. So there's just like, wait a minute, there's just something wrong here. You can't really prove anything or nail it down. The pieces in the jigsaw don't quite fit together.
No, well, I think it's going to be pretty much impossible for anybody to get to the bottom of it. I think that there's such a large investment. Everyone thinks of the case of the killer getting on for a year ago now, in France, who was running amok and shooting people, and the French press was absolutely convinced that it had a white anti-Semitic killer on its hands and was salivating at the prospect of what it could do with this knowledge. And then, of course, the guy gets identified and finally killed, and he turns out to be a Muslim.
Well, yeah, that's the key point there. It's like, what can we do with this story? That seems to be the case here, yeah, too. It's not anybody actually really cares about the victims or anything like that. It's just like, oh, great,
absolutely,
now we've got this narrative we can run with, and we can sort of start pushing our agenda. At that point, though, there does seem to be quite a lot of confusion, because what is the agenda? You know, because instead of sort of like talking about eradicating racism, they started to talk about banning guns.
It's a win-win, I suppose.
Yeah, but which one do they go after? I mean, they've focused, the liberal left have focused their attention on saying, oh, this proves that we need to do away with guns or restrict them more than they have been. But that's not really playing out very well either, because people are saying that actually he had a gun illegally anyway. And so that just proves that if you ban guns, people who want to use guns will get them, and they'll face less opposition that way.
So you're suggesting that perhaps, you know, with his history of psychological problems and that he was influenced in therapy to take didactically extreme actions
Well, I'm not really sure about his history of mental treatment, but the way he's acted with the little that's come out about the kind of person he was doesn't quite gel.
Taking his manifesto at surface value, I have to disagree. I've written a lengthy comment about this. I don't think that this is necessarily going to be harmful to white nationalism.
That's a question that is worth talking about. But I wouldn't automatically say this is bad for white nationalism. White nationalism is already very culturally suppressed in America and most of the West, and so it's not like they can do anything more about that, except unless they start really clamping down on the internet. There's all sorts of problems with them doing that. It really kind of underscores the fact that this kind of post-racial society that liberals have been striving towards is just like never going to happen.
Right.
And that the more multicultural society becomes, essentially, the more racist it becomes. And that's like a cast iron law. And you can try and sort of cover that up, and you can twist the media narrative as much as you like. But, you know, the basic reality is that the more multicultural a society is, the more racist it is. And when this kind of terrible event happens, which shocks everybody at first, it does sort of underline that fundamental reality, which a lot of people are in denial of.
Right, it wakes them up, as opposed to the conditioning from the media that they've been getting, that relationship with blacks is benign, and it's good to live with them and to intermarry with them. This calls attention to the fact that there's an ultimately dangerous relationship here, and it may perform the service of calling attention to this conflict so that people are aware in timely enough of a fashion to do something about it.
The conflict is there all the time. I mean, it's there in the way that people behave and where they live, in what kind of schools they try to send their children to, in how they walk down a street at night. That struggle is all around people already. And it's a two-way thing. Whenever you're in an argument with any liberal, instead of arguing from a white point of view, it's actually better to argue from a black point of view. And as far as black people are concerned, they are not the same. They see the racism. They see that this post-racial society is an impossibility, and they act like racially aware people. They perceive their interests and their group in a very racial way.
So this might facilitate the separatist argument.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of blacks are actually unhappy with this situation. It's not just a problem for whites, and a lot of blacks probably do maybe somewhat naively think that if they could separate from whites, everything would be okay. Probably what would happen to any kind of partition in America, which created a black political entity, would probably before too long go the way of Detroit or Haiti.
The alternative, if you like, from the black point of view to possibly a Detroit or a Haiti, I don't know. Anyway, a black shining city on the hill of some kind. The alternative, in fact, is atomization and withdrawal into a life that is very dissatisfied and self-estranging. This we have known since the 1990s. Robert Putnam, the American sociologist, did some research. He's a liberal. He wanted to look at trends that he'd identified in American urban life towards atomization. And because it was not what he had expected, he expected to see this utopian multiracial existence. And in fact, what he found was that the more multiracialism there was in a given locale, the more there was a tendency for all people to retire into their own lives, and they did not want to participate in any way in the public life of the area. They didn't vote so much. They just didn't, you know, they didn't join clubs. They didn't even join libraries. They didn't get involved in anything on the public scale. They just went in and looked at the television, and that was it. And this is true of everybody.
Yeah, and also,
the book he wrote was Falling Alone. And it should have had a serious impact on liberal thinking. but it didn't.
Yeah.
They just, as you said earlier, they just roll straight over it as though it never happened. They paid no attention to it at all. It's never quoted now, but it was a seminal comment on the entire liberal project. And, you know, it was a very important piece of work. And it, as it happens, you could quite easily tie it in to the total confusion which may produce people like Dylan Roof, and almost certainly produces people like Rachel Dolezal, who has also been in the news over the last couple of weeks.
It's all part of the same thing, isn't it? Because liberalism means you have a choice of one. Because instead of like people deciding whether they want to live in a more kind of individualistic, atomized society or a society which has a more social cohesion and group identity, they simply don't have that choice in America because essentially because of the existence of the black population. Now, we had an article on our site about this very thing written by Alex Fontana, called Angry White Male. And one of the things that he says in that article is that, America was a kind of melting pot in the 19th century. And it was a melting pot basically exclusively for white Europeans. And the people of white European backgrounds from various countries could come to America. And after a generation or two, they could acquire this new conglomerate identity of being American. Yes. And with the existence of the blacks, now the blacks were kind of kept out of sight and for a large part of that history. But in the 20th century, of course, the blacks came to the fore. Has a significant component of American society. But then this is an unassimilable quantity that you simply cannot get people from sub-Saharan Africa, essentially, and assimilate them with people from Europe. Physically, culturally, there's just too many things which are different. And so this sort of blending together of America into a new country made up of all these diverse European populations was essentially interfered with and put on halt, and so you could not have that kind of unified society. And so instead America was pushed down the route of atomized individualism, because that would be the only way to square that circle without actually removing blacks and taking them back to Africa or something.
One shouldn't think that what has happened in America is some kind of wrong turn that's been made in the liberal project. It is the liberal project, and ultimately, the unfettered will has no connection at all to its own nature. That's where it goes.
But a lot of liberals do have a kind of socialistic tendency as well. I mean, it's not impossible for white liberals living in a completely, white town to evolve some kind of social ethos and to actually move away from this kind of atomized individualism. But because of the kind of racial fracture of America, that is not an option. They have to, instead of building that kind of interwoven society, which a lot of liberals, I think, would probably prefer deep down in their hearts, they are forced to move increasingly towards this much more atomized society where everybody doesn't trust each other. Mm-hmm. And, where the only way to exist is to be a self-defining freak.
Would hope that they would choose to identify as European peoples and see the necessity to distinguish themselves not only from blacks, as Roof did, but from Jewish interests and from non-white Hispanics. These latter two groups, Roof didn't make these distinctions well enough. He sees Jews as whites who are just choosing to identify and serve each other in this nepotistic group, and they could somehow be brought around. He would have needed to be more aware of their power and influence. Also, he calls for some reason Hispanics enemies, and this is a really destructive right-wing...
But are you not giving him too much credence?
Let me just finish this thing about Hispanics because it's important. It's a big mistake. It's a language group, so that white people speaking Spanish, non-white people speaking Spanish, they're all lumped together, and he sees them as the enemy. This is really a bad line to draw.
I think that's a valid line to draw as long as the borders remain open. I mean, if you actually manage to, by some miracle, close the U.S. border, then you could start talking about doing away with this kind of Hispanic category, because then you'd start assimilating the whiter part of that population.
Where I think that he's right is in that American patriotism at this point is ridiculous. In this manifesto, he's taking on a kind of white or European patriotism, which is correct. And that should have these white Hispanics be a part of the group to be looked after, and not just a language category.
Because, but I think you're giving him far too much respect. You know, the boy is highly likely to be psychotic, and in cases of this kind involving psychopaths, one water or another, the causes that they espouse are not really where they're coming from. They're not causes at all. They're umbrellas.
I don't think I'm giving him too much respect. I don't think that I don't recommend what he did.
But you're assuming that he's a political actor,
I can take his manifesto.
And he was going to go
because he's
going to go and shoot up a university.
He's involved,
his first choice. He wasn't going to go and kill blacks at all in a church. He was his first choice was a university. He would have done it, but for the fact that it was too tough from the security point of view, too tough a nut to crack. So he chose a soft target.
His actions in relation to that manifesto make sense as, you know, a crude act of white patriotism.
I'm amazed.
Or an act of racial revenge.
But it's psychopathy, yeah, anyway.
This is assuming that everything that we're hearing is
a guy. You don't throw away your life at age 21, you know, to kill people who never did any harm to your people.
No, you have to be seriously mentally ill to do that. Well, not mentally ill necessarily, but you have to have a very, very serious flaw in your psyche.
Well, that's an interesting point, because somebody else was in some article I saw somewhere, I don't really remember where, but I think it actually cropped up in a number of articles and online comments. To actually do what Roof did, you would actually have to be seriously psychotic if you were white, whereas if you were black, to do the same thing, you would not have to be.
How so? I don't know about that.
Yeah, so that kind of psychotic action would be much closer to the group mean for a black person than it would be for a white person. That was the point being made.
I wouldn't like to place too much credence on that.
A point that I wanted to make in his having done this, having chosen such a target, it draws attention to the fact that blacks are a very different people. And he articulated some of the problems: low IQ, low impulse control, more testosterone equals more aggression and violence, such that even the more benign ones, the nicer blacks, are dangerous for us to live with because they bring along with them the more violent ones.
Well, can I just ask?
So it helps as a dividing factor, and to call attention to the fact that living with any blacks is going to be destructive in the long run. This is bringing it home more quickly.
I'm quite surprised at what you're saying. It seems to me to have a major flaw in it, which I don't want to spend too much time talking to you because we're here to talk to Colin. But if you're saying there is a rational basis in psychology, evolutionary psychology, for his worldview, and that his action possibly has an impact on young white men, which will help them to see difference in the world, where
and women too, just in general, it's gonna call attention.
Can I ask you by what rational process you get from this view of yours about it to walking into a church and killing 9 worshippers who have black skin, who you've never met before, and who've been treating you with great kindness?
Well, I don't.
What's the rational?
I don't. the rationale is as I said, he's enacting a group punishment. I don't recommend what he did.
The rationale is it's a war,
right?
And in a war, lots of innocent people get killed, and that seems to be what this action is an attempt to symbolize. It's trying to symbolize an actual war, which other people perhaps are in denial about, or hoping not to see.
What I see is a psychotic who is using a very convenient set of political clothes in order to give himself of justification.
Yeah, but you could get that from anything. You can
psychotic.
Imagine the world is full of lizard people, and then just go out and kill all the lizard people that are looking at you the wrong way. I mean,
rapists will tell you.
There is a kind of ideological element to his action. It's not one we would probably agree with.
No, of course not.
But in his own mind, he's been motivated by a sense of a sort of racial injustice, let's call it.
He's motivated by his psychopathy, and it has to find an expression. It would find any expression.
You have to know what it's like to live with blacks and to be subject to media and academia all your life, telling you that these people are just the same, that you're bad, that there's no problem, you shouldn't object to these people raping and taking your women. You know, after a while, that does become a real organic cause. And
This just makes it all the more remarkable that he had a black friend who seemed to think very highly of him, even after hearing about the shooting.
I can make sense of that situationally. You know, even if you don't like blacks, you can talk to some of them and see friendly things in an episode, and then.
Oh yeah, you can treat people as individuals differently than you can, as groups.
In this modernist fallout, we're all kind of pastiche selves, to some extent.
It's also very, very interesting how things actually happen in the media, because, you know, like a few weeks ago, it was all about Bruce Jenner, this guy who decided to become a woman and. You know, the media were all over him and saying how brave he was and what a great decision that he chose to become a woman. And he always was a woman anyway. That's what a lot of them were saying. And then that was followed up by Rachel Dolezal. And then she was basically just doing what Bruce Jenner was doing, but with race. And okay, there were certain problems with her doing that. A lot of people thought, wait a minute, you know. Should we green light this or not? This is a slippery slope. And then right on the tail of that, we have this shooting in Charleston, which immediately has this kind of the opposite effect of polarizing race again.
Do you think it does? I think it tends to have a short-term effect of empowering pseudo-religious, ultra-liberal types who can, you know, go and bleed all over the public space and tell everybody that, you know, we must light candles and love and this is the solution. I mean, there was a piece written by Tim Stanley, who's a typical liberal leftist, in the Daily Telegraph about, you know, the power of love that will cure this terrible problem, da 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 da, you know. It's empowered them. There's been an awful lot of feeling like that initially with Breivik as well. There's huge marches, candles, torches, I think they were, in Oslo.
But in a funny way, all that signaling about interracial brotherhood and harmony, all that signaling, it's sort of like a balancing mechanism for people's everyday actual racism, which is what they live by, living in certain neighborhoods, avoiding certain groups, and, you know, the way they behave in their daily life. So most people in America are living de facto racist lives, and they feel a bit uncomfortable with that. So, you know, if they can sort of signal about how terrible they think this event is, and how much they think love is the answer, then that's all the better. It helps them to square the circle.
With this manifesto saying what it does, and with changing media now with the internet, I don't think that they're going to be able to control the spin quite so much.
Yeah, well, a lot of it sort of, a lot of the energy has gone into the gun debate, and I think you know, that's a battle that's been fought so many times before in America, and it's like, it's almost like the trenches of World War One. You know, both armies know they can't really break through, and so, you know, a lot of that energy has now sort of been diverted to the issue of the South Carolina state flag, and whether that flag should be lowered at half mast, and whether it should be abolished and replaced with some kind of lovely rainbow flag or whatever, you know. So it's sort of interesting the way that the energy of the kind of the cultural and ideological divide gets diverted. So first of all, this is a on the surface, this is an act committed by a racist who had easy access to guns. So instead of trying to deal with the thorny and intractable problem of race and the fact that you can't abolish people's racial identity and the way they perceive things, it's sort of flowed into the gun debate. But then it's kind of like realized, uh-oh, we were here before not so long ago and we didn't get anywhere. And now it's just jumped over to this rather trivial issue of whether South Carolina should change its flag or not.
But coming back to the gun thing just for a second, because there's a couple of really interesting parallels to Switzerland. Switzerland has a high rate of gun ownership. As a matter of fact, I think every adult is supposed to have one. And yet they have very little gun violence.
I think Switzerland's the ranked fourth in gun ownership, with a rate of 45.7%, and America is about 88.8%.
And another parallel with comparison to Switzerland is, I heard that if you could take the blacks out of America, the homicide rate in America would be quite similar to that of Switzerland. So that's a very telling fact, to the extent that it's true as well.
Well, that's also true with Canada, isn't it? Because what was that Michael Moore film, Bowling for Columbine, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And I think the big point he made was, you know, Canada, they have lots of guns, but they don't go around shooting people like we do. So therefore, there's something wrong with America. But of course, he never put his finger on what exactly was the main difference between Canada and America.
Right.
Okay. I think we've come to a point where we can change horses a little bit and talk about another matter with a racial underpinning. And that's the crisis of partially of refugees, but mostly of economic migrants forcing their way into Europe, both from Libya and also from Turkey, coming out of Syria and Iraq. But an awful lot of these people, it turns out, aren't in fact Syrians or Iraqis, even the ones coming from Turkey. A lot of those turn out to be Bangladeshis and even Africans that are on those boats. So, Colin, you've observed this. What sort of thoughts have you had when you see all these poor people in boats and being given lifts to the coast and being given blankets?
It's sort of ridiculous. There was a ship from the Royal Navy that was HMS down in the Mediterranean, and they were, of course, acting as a kind of ferry service, practically. Yes. They were sailing out to whichever leaky boat crowded with immigrants they could find that day, and then taking them on board, and then sailing due north to Italy and the refugee camps and the routes into the rest of Europe. And I think that ship actually developed engine trouble because it was working so hard as a kind of ferry service for the third world.
And of course, it will only encourage more to come.
Yeah, it's obviously insane. I mean, if we want a suitable model that we should look to, there's a fine example being provided by Australia. They've made up their minds that they're not going to be swamped by boat people, and they've realized that if you let one boat get through and you allow those people then to enjoy the benefits of a a first world society, then, you know, that just incentivizes the rest to come. So basically, what this is, I mean, this is really a desire for third world people to be recolonized by whites. I mean, because we used to run their countries, we used to impose, you know, law and order, and we used to build roads and schools and improve things. And their living standards were rising because of white rule, and we left. And they've never really kind of forgotten that, and they just want to come back to the you know, inverted.
But it seems like GW supplies another important factor that we might consider. That is how we are the Gentiles, the undifferentiated others, so that even Africans wouldn't be different. It's kind of, you know, another expression of this this gender confusion and so on, and this identity confusion. That's been,
yeah, well, I know all about that. Living in ongoing in Japan. In Japan, all foreigners are called gaijin.
Yeah, but that's Japan. And, where
that can be, it could be anything, really. You know, it could be white, black, yellow, Chinese, whatever, as long as you're not Japanese. So
Yeah, but we're Europeans, and we have no difference as Gentiles. We are part of the universe.
We're striving to achieve this condition of not being different, of being an amorphous whole. And, you know, hyper-individualism, which is the beating heart of the liberal theology, does in fact accord perfectly with this. So there's never really a conflict between the kind of thought world that we live in, this liberal thought world, and its sacred objects.
Hasn't there been a deliberate Jewish hand in this?
Yes, I mean, of course.
Their media control didn't just begin with Hollywood, but I think that Bowery drew a good parallel to the Bible being the media of ancient times.
Well, you'd have to say, realistically, in Europe, the answer to that is, okay, America's its own case, but in Europe, the answer to that is probably, on balance, no. What you might be able to make a case, if the knowledge was available, and it isn't in the public sphere, is for a Jewish hand, possibly, within the councils of the powerful, particularly in terms of
bribes.
Bodies like the UN, IMF, Bilderberg, all the rest of that sort of thing, the internationalism, which do condition governments. Most famous case, I suppose, recently has been the spread of gay marriage law, which has suddenly cropped up like a rash all over the West. And, you know, but that is a UN agenda, I believe. So, you know, these things may well be passed down, in essence, to the political elites of a given country.
Where are they coming from then, exactly? Where's the point of origin?
It's a good question. The point of origin would be in the Jewish identity of leading members of the global institutions.
Gay marriage and homosexualism, you know, this kind of blatant promotion of homosexual values and lifestyles,
yes,
is so kind of against, essentially against the fundamental nature of most people, that it would, yes, be likely to at some point provoke a reaction.
Yeah, well, this whole,
especially on top of all the other things that they
reaction. We are part of the reaction. You and I and Daniel, we're part of that. Mm. There is a reaction, and you know, every time there's a honest opinion poll about anything, you know, you will see the reaction feeding through, and actually it's quite strong, but it's totally ignored. And it has absolutely no grip on the political class. What does seem to have a grip on
Ireland was an interesting case, because they recently had a vote on gay marriage, didn't they?
Well, they didn't, actually. And they had a vote on the Catholic. They had a vote on Catholicism, but it was not
really. I think it was phrased as a vote on gay marriage, wasn't it?
But the nature of the debate, which was highly skewed, by the way. A foreign organization spent loads of money on it, and there was very, very little done by the No campaign, and the church was very, very restricted in what it could say. Also, you know, presented to the younger half, certainly, men and women of reproductive age say.
Finishing up
a very unappealing prospect. So it was a vote in the end for change. It became a symbol for change, and I don't think that the
It kind of reminded me a little bit of the referendum on Scottish independence, because you had the establishment all on one side, and you had all the big money and the big business all back in one side of the question, and if you bring enough power to bear like that, you can sort of bend and twist people in these votes. And it was the vote in Scotland, it was also quite a kind of narrow victory for the choice of the establishment.
Yes, but you have to ask this question: why did the establishment want to do this? I mean, David Cameron never really mentioned the thing prior to the election in 2010. I think it was 24 hours before the vote.
It seems like they're trying to demoralize white men, doesn't it?
Just let me finish. They issued an advisory note saying that they would consider the merits of the matter. So it was a supplementary to the manifesto, which had been out for, I suppose, about 10 weeks, 8 to 10 weeks. And that was the full extent that the public were... Nobody paid attention to that or even saw it or knew about it. That was the full extent to which the public were admitted to the debate prior to the election on the homosexualization of marriage and the redefinition of the primary means that we possess for raising healthy whole children. So that was what they actually did, and the Labour Party would also have pushed this through had they won. This is the point, that it's being forced through.
But I think it's also possible to see this as an issue that most people who, most people are obviously not gay, and most people don't really, they might have some views on the matter, but they don't really have any integral connection to this issue, and they sort of don't really care, and so they're prepared to just let it go away. And then on the other hand, you do have the gay community, and they, even though they're not really that interested in getting married, they do support this idea because it sort of accords their deviant form of sexuality equality with or even superiority to normal sexual behavior.
Well, it is superior, so because them, you've also got this additional category of a civil partnership. At the moment.
I mean, so they're coming at it very well. I mean, for them, it has totemic value, and they want it. And you have these very kind of motivated minorities, and so politicians tend to kind of, unless there's a countervailing force, politicians tend to just give those kind of groups what they want.
I don't believe that this has come from this particular process, is what it is, has come from the groups as such. I don't believe that Stonewall led this. I could see that Stonewall campaigned on AIDS and had some effect on the government of the day, but I don't believe that this has been achieved through that means. I believe that it's come from higher agendas in the international. So I'm still trying to answer your original question.
GW, come into in connection with that that issue and separating from the elites. I think that you wanted to say a few things about Greece.
Well, what's happening there? That's interesting that the Troika. This is the European Commission, European Central Bank, and the IMF has been more or less controlling Greek governments and forcing them into a position whereby they've had to obey an immensely destructive and humiliating program of debt repayment. And the debt, let us never forget, is created digitally.
From Goldman Sachs.
Goldman Sachs actually pushed Greece into the euro in the first place by producing a report which turns out to be untrue, on which the European Commission agreed that they met the parameters necessary to join the project.
Which sounds funny now, yeah, definitely.
Well, in fact,
they can just give Goldman Sachs the Parthenon.
Well, that, you say that, but that is what it's all about in the end. It's like a leverage scheme from the 1980s. You know, it's like those guys in Wall Street who were running those scams, picking up businesses for nothing. And you know, this is exactly the same thing, except they've managed to leverage a small nation, which is pretty neat. You know, and a model for others, I suspect, for the future, because the euro has extreme imbalances in it that will, in the end, that will catch Spain, Italy, Ireland. It will get them in the end. But the interesting thing is that the Greeks have got an opportunity now to change the course of this, change history, and to leave and make a very, very public point that an economy can succeed, even if it's small, and even if it's weak, but its people can live well enough, they can live with dignity and pride, and that in itself would be a great victory over where they are now and where they will be for a long time to come if the Troika does manage to pull this off and keep them inside.
I think you two should talk. We should talk about the British perspective on all this and what they might do.
This feeds into the forthcoming. We don't know when it's going to be yet, but sometime before the end of 2017, which is the referendum on Britain's exit from the European Union.
And that's probably going to have some similarity to both the Irish referendum on gay marriage and the Scottish referendum on independence. You're going to have all the media power concentrated on one side, and you're going to have all the money concentrated on one side, and all the big guns from the establishment will be rolled out, and they'll be doing everything they can to persuade the British voter to stay in the EU.
They'll use fear mostly. They'll use like
they did with the Scottish referendum on independence. They'll say if you vote against the EU, all these companies are going to up sticks and disappear. That has a big effect on people.
Some of the companies will say that, but they won't do it.
Yeah, there'll be enough people saying that to them for them to construct a very plausible narrative of economic doom if they vote to leave the EU. And, you can just see how that would probably work out. Most people will be cowed and cajoled to vote as they're being told.
But Colin, you've been very skeptical of UKIP, haven't you? That you see them as connected with neoliberal big money and Austrian school things.
Well, that's their origins. That's where they kind of come from. But ideology is tends to be very flexible when you have political opportunities. And Britain's always kind of operated as a kind of two-party state with two main parties that alternate in government. And of course, there's occasionally been some smaller parties that have tried to have a slice of the action, like the Liberal Party and the SDP and so on. More recently, you've had nationalist parties from the Celtic fringe. But essentially, the British political system requires two almost equally large-sized political parties. And for most of the 20th century, that's been the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. And the Conservative Party's slightly more the natural party of government. And the Labour Party has always had to stretch a bit more to sort of fulfil its role. But with the recent election and the sort of eradication almost of the Labour Party in one of its traditional homelands, namely Scotland, the Labour Party now seems to be kind of incapable of fulfilling that traditional second party role.
It's in shock.
Yeah, that kind of creates the possibility for UKIP to sort of fill that niche. Because one thing about UKIP, one of the things that really counted against them at the election was the fact that their support was not particularly concentrated in one area. You know, of course, under the British electoral system, if you have your support geographically concentrated, that usually translates into a loss of seats in Parliament, and it certainly benefited the Scottish National Party, who had tremendously good result on essentially a numerically still quite small part of the vote. Now that also means that UKIP have got they've got support in most parts of the country, and in that sense you could say they are, despite having only one MP, they are in a sense a national party. They're popular in the south, they're popular in the north. I mean, they had quite good results in a lot of the Labour constituencies, which have traditionally very low turnout. And so there is a possibility that if they steer the right course and play their cards well, that people will flock to them, and that would of course mean reneging on their ideological roots, and they have done that to some extent, because like all British successful British political parties, they've sort of prostrated themselves at the altar of the National Health Service and the welfare state.
Well, they have, but the choices that are available to them are a bit limited. Immediately after the election, Farage, when he knew he wasn't going to win, he was actually walking to the account to get the result, was speaking to a number of journalists who were sort of gathering around him, walking along, sticking a microphone in his face, throwing questions at him. And he said that UKIP in the future will move in its focus and its appeal, and the UKIP of the future will be much younger and will involve people who have a quite different kind of outlook generally, and a different view of what it means to be independent from the mainstream parties. In essence, he was kissing goodbye to the Tory convert who promptly went back out of fear of the Scots to voting Tory in May, but also to the Carswell element in the party. They have one remaining MP, which is Douglas Carswell, who's a libertarian, and they have turned their back really for the future, if what he says is correct, Farage, on that libertarian element. I think that probably about 15 or 20% of the party would describe itself as ideologically libertarian. So there's clearly some struggle that's going to go on from here with these people who try to preserve it. And some of them may leave the party in disgust or go off into the press and say terrible things. We seem to have passed the point where Carswell was going to be one of those. But there's been some substantial losses. They lost a vice chairman of the party. And the party went through quite a sort of few days. They now appear to have a crisis in terms of their relationship to the forthcoming campaign to get Britain out of the EU, because they want to be very involved. They've seen the Scots Nationalist Party, who fought the referendum up there and lost, but gained an enormous amount of support, which came through in the general election only a few weeks later. Interesting thing is that UKIP might be happy to lose this particular referendum if they get the same boost, because in the long run they will see themselves as being able to get us out of Europe through their own will and force.
There's a very good analogy there, because the reason the SNP did so well at the general election was because they represented one entire side of the independence debate, and that kind of polarized the country into two halves. And so all those people who were in favor of independence then voted for the SNP, whereas the unionist vote was split between the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, and the Liberals. And that meant a landslide for the SNP. And if you have a very kind of polarizing debate on membership of the EU, and of course in that debate the UKIP will entirely dominate the case for leaving the EU, and the other main parties will all be sharing the other side, and so that could have exactly the same kind of dynamic. Whereas UKIP polarized the country on the basis of this question, and then half the country goes with UKIP, and that would really make you know, make them into one of the main parties.
Yeah, I didn't realize you were in a restaurant, actually, Colin. Okay, let's move on to the last element that I think we need to cover, which is the state of nationalism, which follows on quite well from the UKIP thing, because obviously UKIP is not a nationalist party, but it does, in a lot of ways, hold interest for nationalists. I believe that to a large extent, nationalism has gone into support for UKIP. We have that option. Obviously, we don't have any chance at the present time of having a genuine nationalist party in this country. There are one or two quite good people remaining. I'm thinking particularly of Paul at Liberty GB, who I've got a lot of respect for, Paul Weston. But it's a pretty poor outlook, generally. So what's your general take on nationalism in the UK? And I mean, you know, if you, I know you write a lot about it, but what's your take post-Roof on nationalism, white nationalism in the States?
Well, in the case of Britain, you know, because I think it's pretty hard to kind of tie the two together, America and Britain.
Yes.
But in the case of Britain, obviously nationalism, overt, explicit, you get what you see. Kind of nationalism is has sort of died a death, and a lot of that's to do with what happened to the BNP and ultimately toxic and poisonous leadership of Nick Griffin. And that's also been affected by UKIP, because I remember several years ago when the BNP were doing well, the media were always boosting UKIP. I mean, it was always being very positive about UKIP, and that's because they wanted UKIP to serve the function of deflating the BNP. And now that you know, the BNP has sort of practically disappeared, the you get all these kind of negative scare stories about UKIP and how nasty they are. So yeah, we are in a sort of phase of either soft nationalism or displaced nationalism, and UKIP kind of fill that slot for a lot of people. People do feel uncomfortable in modern multicultural Britain supporting a clear-cut nationalist party. UKIP are nicely positioned so that people can sort of feel they're doing something for Britain, but without feeling like they're being overly nasty to their various non-white friends and colleagues.
Well, if we're going to see a growth of UKIP, we're not going to see any nationalism in the short or medium term, are we? We're not going to see a real party emerge. It seems to me that the only prospect for a genuine nationalism, and let's be honest about this, without a genuine nationalism, we're not going to survive as a people. You will be well aware of all of the issues relating to demographics and what the future means. My own take on it is that we've got something like 2045, 2050 before we are a strict minority. And I mean, over the next 10 years after that, 15 years after that, you know, we're going to be marginalized politically increasingly, and the future is very, very bleak from there on.
The reason people don't vote nationalist now is they don't feel threatened enough. Maybe we need to get to something like 40% non-white before people actually do wake up.
I don't know, but the fact is that in the interim, you know, UKIP does things which are useful in terms of a platform which can be taken on and used. And my own view is that what will happen if UKIP can grow and replace, I used to think it would be the Tory party. I think most people thought it would be the Tory party, but now it's looking increasingly like the Labour party. Good luck to them. Then that will eventually give the possibility for a split within UKIP between those who want to go on and produce a genuine politics for our people and those who want to remain within the trammels of a generally liberal and establishmentarian view of what politics is. So, you know, I'm happy that UKIP exists. I'm relieved that UKIP exists. But obviously the establishment has to try to keep them as a minority party. And obviously as nationalists, we have to see them grow to the point where we can piggyback them and get some benefit.
Yeah, they are creating lots of space for, more overtly nationalist politics. And it's obvious that that most of Europe, and including the UK, is moving in a more kind of right-wing and ethnocentric direction. And even the last election, you could say the last election was really the first truly ethnocentric election. But instead of being a focused on white versus non-white, it was focused on the main old ethnic division in the UK, which is that between Scotland and England.
Yeah.
And so you had this Scottish Nationalist Party. Okay, they're a civic nationalist party. They're very left wing, but still that represented a kind of ethnocentric response to politics. And at the same time, you had a lot of people thinking, "Oh, we have to vote for David Cameron, otherwise we'll be blackmailed by the SNP in cahoots with David Miliband." And so there was quite a lot of ethnocentrism in the last election. And once those things start to develop, they can actually develop very, very quickly. So right. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the next election.
Okay. America.
Stay with British politics. This is a unique opportunity
Yeah, I mean, nothing's going to happen in America anyway.
Well, you say that, but
There might be
a groundswell.
A white nationalism is a worthy topic, but it's something that it's best to take on another day. What you two are saying about British politics is interesting and important.
Well, European politics is always more interesting than American politics because we have these third, fourth, and fifth parties, and they can suddenly rise up and sweep the nation. And we have things like proportional representation, and we have European elections and national elections, and in Britain we also have the Scottish and Welsh parliamentary elections. So you have all these opportunities for other parties to rise up and embody the dissatisfaction of the people,
whereas in America we have the evil party and the egregious party.
Yeah, you've just got the only thing you've got is somebody like Donald Trump, who comes along and he's been saying some interesting things recently. And, I think he's starting to attract a bit of attention. But I really wonder, is he going to the system will find some way of squeezing him out. And then it'll just be back to, business as normal.
And Coulter. He's got to get married to Ann Coulter.
Yeah, I don't know why she doesn't run, actually.
That actually is interesting because she is, with the comments she's been making, and, she's a big figure and she gets on prime time all the time, yeah? And she is moving the Overton window, I think, in America. So you are starting to see signs of ethnocentrism entering American politics. Of course, it entered American politics with the election of Obama. It's just that a lot of white people didn't realize it at the time. And with white voting patterns are also starting to become much more ethnically determined, I guess.
Would you agree with that, Daniel?
Sure, that could be.
Yeah, it's the only problem is that whites are voting for the Republican Party, and the Republican Party doesn't have any idea doesn't have any notion of actually representing those white voters. And meanwhile, they're bothering themselves about how they can get more Hispanic voters or Asian voters.
That's just the big money party. They don't care. They take advantage of the fact that white people will vote for them, but they don't represent whites at all. The foreigners don't understand it. The corporations, they're not identifying as white. They're not acting in white interests, even though people are blaming them as white.
Yeah, but with that level of essential disenfranchisement of the American voter, that does leave a lot of potential for somebody to come along and sort of take advantage of that. And at the moment, I guess Trump seems to be trying to, you know, fit into that role. He's been the lightning rod for all this this static in the air, all this unrepresented electricity.
I can't take him seriously.
No, I don't think he's serious. I think that Ron Paul was more serious during his runs than that. You know, he had a lot of young people involved. There was a sense of excitement and about the campaign. And, you know, one felt, wow, this is going somewhere. It's the internet. It's new. He's saying incredibly fresh things, which, you know, wouldn't go down too many countries in the world, but they do in America. And this could take off. And it died for whatever reason.
He was just allowed to go as far as he would because he diverted white voters and white ethnocentrism into the libertarian Austrian school.
Do you think that's a factor at all in anybody's thinking in the American establishment? Do you think they ever think about white interests in that way?
No, they were thinking opposed to white interests.
Yes, I know, but do you think they consider them?
They're thinking we have to diffuse this in some way. We have to throw them a bone. And
the Fed stuff was just throwing them a bone.
You've got to throw them a stick to chase. You know,
I think it's the same thing with UKIP. It's the coming out of the European Union is throwing a bone.
Well, they won't want us to come out of the European Union. I mean, if you look at the great objectives of
They don't want to end the Fed either.
Of creating the globality, you've got to create these trading blocks, and then you've got to unite these trading blocks. And there's already a move underway to unite America and Europe. That is a process which is rather slowly and difficultly being brought to birth.
Brzezinski is trying to do that.
I mean, this is the way that they will proceed. So, you know, you don't want a major economy to suddenly be forced to listen to its voters and turn its back on this process.
They know that the people want to come out of the European Union and that their opposition is going to be partial to that. So they'll allow someone like Farage to articulate that position very well and draw them and divert their potential opposition into futility of the propositional idea of libertarianism, of Austrian school economics. That's controlled opposition. And Ron Paul was the same thing in the American version, but with the end the Fed. Yes, it'd be nice to end the Fed. And he articulates that position and he draws the people who would be the opposition and who would want that into futility.
But they haven't got anything else anyway.
What?
In America.
Anything else other than Ron Paul?
Yeah.
He wasn't a serious alternative either. He was only going to go so far.
Yeah, fair enough. But you have to take him as being a figurehead for something, even if it's just a very inchoate, undifferentiated sense of discontent that can alight on the issue of the Fed or you know, whatever else he's pushing. It's something. It's a beginning, and this is how I think.
We can rest these issues to our purposes. That's true.
Probably there is no possibility in a polity controlled, a liberal polity controlled by vast financial power and other interests. In general, there's probably about five different interest groups, certainly in this country, who are actually to some extent quite aggrieved with each other, but their major interests are congruent, and their major interests lead into the globalist program, as it were. And all of those are within the general aegis of the establishment, even I would suggest the Marxian left, the academic left.
Brzezinski is talking about that quite explicitly. I'll add a link to this post when it's on.
But in that case, if everything is like kind of fake opposition, everything's being controlled, and all these blocks are being formed and merged together, who's the real opposition to that in the world today?
We are.
Well, this is a very sad state of affairs then, if it's...
Well, I agree with that. It is sad.
You know, the thing is that, as I said about UKIP, you know, I do believe that these movements are the only way that we can find a little bit of expression, and the only hope we've got that they might grow if something like the Labour Party collapse occurs, and enter the frame properly. And whereas there'll be a nativization process going on in terms of the party hierarchy, who will become very comfortable with the establishmentarian existence, there are opportunities for a serious split in the party and the entry then finally of a nationalist analysis, and for people like you and I to say our piece and be heard, which is not the case at the moment. So, you know, I do think that we have to be grateful for small mercies, because we haven't got much else. France is a very good case in point. You know, France had a very strong nationalist, or quite fascistic nationalist party built around French wounded feelings after Algeria and so on. And it had a chap at the fore for years and years and years who was quite content to tweak the Jewish tail and to be taken for court, thought it was all, you know, jolly good wheeze. And he liked being notorious. He's obviously got a great taste for that, and he's still at it. And you know, you have to say that, okay, they had one good election, but as a serious political force, even in France, even getting normally something like 10 to 12, maybe 15% of votes, they did not have a real prospect of growing into anything. And this is the great problem. So you have to say, how can a movement arise that we can piggyback if we can't create our own? The French have decided that...
So you're talking about a form of entryism.
Yes. Sorry, the French have got this thing running now, the FN, with the civic nationalism, a fairly civic form of nationalism. Great. Yeah, I'm all in favour of her. I hope they succeed, because that's the only path by which we will be able to speak. Through...
Yeah, the ultimate success. Form of entryism... The ultimate form of entryism is entryism into the ruling global elites. Because, you know, something that that doesn't make sense to me is, why would these ruling global elites want to flood the world with low productive third world people, when, you know, history and science basically proves that the most productive people are Northern European white people?
Well, they would take the view that they'll always be an educated elite that can serve the requirements of the corporations, and that the corporations will always be able to choose the best, whether they are Indians, you know, with, there are elements in the Indian population which are very intelligent. They'll always be able to rely upon that. They'll always be able to rely upon Europeans. I mean,
but the way they're running things, and the kind of population projections that are currently coming out, is that 50 years down the road, most of the world's population is going to be people with an IQ of about 70.
They're talking about reducing creating, the population.
Detroits and Haiti's everywhere.
Mm. They're talking about reducing the population of the world, aren't they? I mean, this is what's on the internet, and I don't know how realistic it is in private conversations of these people, but I don't think they do want that kind of world in the longer run.
Well, they're doing a very good job with the European populations, but I don't really see how that makes their world, which they run and which benefits them and gives them all the good things that they enjoy. Yeah, I don't see how that kind of benefits that world.
Well, if you consider that the most powerful elements in the global elites are Jews, this is the dynastic elements of international finance. They are the most respected within that particular field. So what is it that occupies the thinking of these people? Is it a Jewish perspective? Is it, in fact, that they cannot escape their own Jewish outlook, and they must produce a world in which the great vision of Jews ceasing to exist as Jews, but becoming a priestly caste that speaks directly to God, you know, and passes on his commentary about the universe to the rest of these beings. They're treated with love and kindness. Their feet are washed in milk, and all the possessions of the loving humanity are placed at their feet, and all the rest of this stuff, the rabbis have found over the last several centuries to talk to themselves about. So if that's the mentality of the Jewish element of the global elites, how much of that actually feeds into, now you have to understand that if you go back to evolutionary psychology, I know that you like that, I know that you're a fan of McDonald, the Jewish project has to be understood, Judaism has to be understood, the great appeal of Judaism has to be understood in terms of the relationship of this persecuted minority under so many, Egyptians, Babylonians, Greeks, Rome, Northern Europeans, Russians, these huge, secure, dominant, unkind peoples formed an extremely challenging evolutionary environment. Another thing about this is that we commonly say to one another as nationalists, the European mind was formed by the cold climate of the North. And that the requirements that were made, our individualism and all the rest of it, it's all shaped towards that. Well, the environment for Ashkenazim and what McDonald calls Eastern Jews isn't geographic. It's human and it's us. Mm-hmm. And they've selected for particularities of our life and our psyche. And the form of that selection has been towards their own supremacism, and that's Judaism. That's how it's practiced.
Yeah, of course,
today.
These arguments are quite well known in our neck of the woods, but I think there are questions about this kind of theory, because if you look at Jewish interbreeding patterns, I mean, the most intelligent Jews are having the lowest birth rate, they're intermarrying the most, and then the less intelligent Jews, they're the more kind of like the religious zealot Jews, the Hasidic Jews, lower IQs, they're having more kids. So
can I comment about that? Can I just make a small comment about that? 1994, Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray. Published the bell curve. Herrnstein's motive for doing so was because he'd become concerned about a division between the interests of the cognitive elite, as he called it, in Jewry, not general, in Jewry, and the interests of Jews at large. And he felt that this was a very dangerous development for all Jewry. Now, he's gone. He didn't even survive to see the reception of the book. He did survive to hold it in his hands. He died of cancer in hospital. And I believe that the guy who runs VDare actually went to see him and gave him a copy of the book, which is quite a fine thing to have done. And I think Herrnstein on balance was...
Peter Brimelow.
Yes. Well, what does this division actually imply that he perceived? And he labored over that book. Forget about what the book's famous for. It's only one chapter. The book is really about cognitive dissonance, and we need therefore to think about what he was talking about, and that is the answer to your question, namely that the elites in globalism are still Jews, and they're still working through the Jewish pattern, and they're still producing this world. It's now the globality rather than Olam Haba, but it may not be a world which serves the interests of the majority of Jews. This was, I believe, what Herrnstein was concerned about. And I think he was happy to see a continuation of the old Jewish project the return of the Messiah, the return of God to his house, and the anointing of the Jews as God's people and all the rest of it. But I don't think he would have wanted to have seen it bastardized in this other form. Now, this other form explains, to answer your earlier question, why we've still got this massive process of immigration into the West and our deracination and replacement in train. And we should say this is not Jews. This is not the Jews. I don't like that phrase, and I don't believe it. I think the Jews present their own challenges to us, but this is being done by our governments and our governments are part of a separate mentality into which you've already said you see it in the Republican Party, which is the big money party, you know, it's nothing to do with the voters. Same with the Conservative Party, to be honest. You know, they have a Jewish element. They have a very powerful Jewish element in their very highest levels. So this is my explanation, really, in the sort of meta sense of what's going on. And we can affect it. The interesting thing is we can affect it. The elites are not permanent. The process is not inevitable. It's not secure. Even Richard Herrnstein, within jury, wanted to change it, though it may be beneficial to jury, it may be not, but it's not true to jury, and he wanted to change it.
Yeah, there's lots of internal divisions, and there's and it's you know, a lot of people have a tendency to be very reductionist about everything and look for one simple explanation, and I don't think we should fall into that trap. Yeah. It's a very complex picture, and there's quite a lot of random elements, and there's a lot of unintended consequences as well. So there's plenty for people from our side to work with. Yeah. So what I don't like is that what I don't like is these people who sort of bang on about how the Jews control everything, and that's just that just takes away anybody's motivation to get out of bed in the morning, I'd say.
Well, it is defeatist in the end, you know. Oh me, oh my. No. We are the most creative and adventurous race on the planet. You know, if you just look at what the British, the English, the Scots and the Welsh actually created in the world in the 18th and 19th century. Absolutely fantastic. Quite extraordinary, you know, and earlier than that, the gift of this little people to the world has been immense, totally comparable with the Greeks and Romans. And, you know, we really do need to understand that Europeans as a whole are the most adventurous, creative and precious tribe, and we have no reason to regard ourselves as being incapable of restoring power to us, to our own self, and of doing all that can be done for good of all the world.
I agree.
I think on that very, very positive note, we should probably end this fascinating conversation.
Yeah. Well, let's do it again. I mean, one of the things we gave ourselves a pass on was talking metapolitically, and I'd like to do that, Colin, with you at some point in the near future. I'm sure we'd find enough to talk about anyway.
Sure.
But thank you very much. It's been fascinating and very good to speak to somebody who, like us, is struggling through the world of websites to get the voice out. And thanks very much indeed.
Thanks to both of you.
Yeah, it's been great talking to both of you, Daniel and GW. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thanks.